For years, beginning with the innovative Theater of War project that he founded, Brian Dorries has been traveling around the U.S. and the world producing ancient Greek tragedies for current and returned servicemen and women, as well as the terminally ill, hospice nurses, corrections officers, addicts, victims of natural disasters, and a wide range of other at-risk people. These performances, coupled with panels and audience discussion, help initiate conversations in these communities about the visible and invisible wounds of trauma and war. Brian has now written a new book. It's entitled The Theater of War: What Ancient Greek Tragedies Can Teach Us Today. He writes powerfully about the redemptive and therapeutic potential of art, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Brian, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
When I was reading this book, the stories are incredible, and it just gets back to sort of the germ of the idea of how you even begin to think of such a thing.
So, yeah, I mean, I was just a normal citizen. I didn't know anyone in the U.S. military when I got started, but I had opposed the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'd even marched against them in the streets of New York, but I didn't feel quite safe in my rarefied world, reading the Times and reading other newspapers like the Washington Post about the ways that veterans were being retreated by both our government and our medical system when they returned home. And so the germ of the idea, or at least the impulse to do this work, in many ways began with the Walter Reed scandal in 2007, when a national story was broken about how our nation's top Army medical hospital had been under-resourced, and veterans who were returning from Iraq and Afghanistan were meeting substandard care. That woke me up. And, you know, all I had was Greek and Latin. I was a classic student, but the plays that I had loved as a student and as a director all of a sudden seemed like they could have been ripped from the headlines of the morning newspaper. And I got this idea, if I could simply put these ancient Greek war stories about trauma, betrayal, and loss in front of audiences that had experienced those themes and those emotions, that something powerful and hopefully healing would happen.
For many readers who will have a brush with Greek tragedies, perhaps in high school or college, maybe contemporary isn't the word that immediately jumps out at you as what you get out of that experience. What you find out in the book, though, is through your translation and through working with very specific pieces of art, that's exactly what you can do with them.
Yeah, I mean, most of our audience members, again, who've lived the experiences described in the plays, who have skin in the game, so to speak, when they come up to us afterwards, they don't say, that seemed like high poetry or, you know, what I imagine Greek tragedy they would be. They come up and they say, that sounds like kitchen sink realism. That sounds like something I said to my wife last night at the dinner table. And it's not that we've changed the tone or the emotional scale of the Greek plays. In fact, quite to the contrary, the actors we use commit all the way. Tears are flowing and spit is flying and vocal cords are being shredded. It's just that we've chosen to put these plays in front of audiences for whom those experiences actually, in some ways, may seem tame compared to what they've gone through. And that unlocks something. I contend in my book and also in my translations, which have just come out through Vintage as well, that in some ways we need audiences who've lived the experiences these plays describe to help us understand what these plays signify today. Their relevance, their significance in the contemporary world doesn't necessarily live on the page. It lives in the audience for whom we perform them.
You do write in the beginning of the book that the first thing you learn in school about tragedy is that it tells the story of a good and prosperous individual who is brought to ruin by some defect in his or her character. Where does it go from there?
Well, I mean, that's what we hear in high school, and that's the general unit on Greek tragedy that you probably encounter, you know, either as a high school or college student. But I think one of the challenges of that interpretation, or that sort of oversimplification of Aristotle's description of tragedy and his poetics, is that it kind of imbues our understanding of Greek tragedy with a sense of moral judgment. The idea that the characters have what you hear in high school or college as tragic flaws, I think, may be the greatest misnomer there is. From my perspective, the word for flaw in ancient Greek that Aristotle uses, hamartia, later in the New Testament in Greek during the later part of the period, comes to mean sin. And I think that in some ways that's the connotation the tragic flaw has, that we judge characters for making these massive mistakes. But, you know, I really think that the human condition is about making mistakes and learning from them. And the characters in Greek tragedies are no more flawed than the rest of us. They stand at this, you know, this juncture between ignorance and understanding of their choices and their agency. And they're not flawed in any, you know, moral sense. They're simply making mistakes in very high-stakes situations in which their mistakes cost lives and ruin generations. So from that perspective, Greek tragedy isn't, for me, about sending us home pessimistic and nihilistic about our own futility in a world in which we barely apprehend our place and our own role. Greek tragedy, for me, is about waking audiences up to the possibility of making a decision before it's too late that might change their lives for the better. And so the plays may be depressing and dark on the stage, but again, I redirect our attention back to the audience. What's the effect that those watching those plays has on an audience? Does it fill them with despair, or actually is there hope to be found in collectively facing these dark stories together as communities?
I'd like to explore that for a moment when you look at the hope. Because another big part of this, at least when I was learning about Greek tragedies, was the other big elephant in the room was fate.
Yeah.
What is the fate?
Yeah, so, I mean, again, there's a high school sort of binary debate where you're asked to write an essay, you know, where you have to choose between fate and free will in Greek tragedy and the depiction of Greek tragedy of those themes. You know, fate in ancient Greek, moira, means one's portion. One's allotment. I think, at least in my mind, fate describes the conditions or the cards we've been dealt. You know, you can think of fate as our genetic conditions. You know, my father was a diabetic, and I talk about him in the book. He had a type 2 diabetes, and his fate was to struggle with that disease. Now, 60 or more percent of diabetics are not compliant with their medical regimes. Fate, in this instance, was the fact that he had diabetes, but his agency, his moral agency, his ability to make decisions actually, in some ways, determined the course his disease would take. It's the same for Greek tragedy, same for characters in Greek tragedy. They have a set of conditions in which they've been born. Oedipus is born into a set of conditions, but it's the decisions we see him making on stage that determine the outcome of the story and of his story. Heraclitus said the pre-Socratic philosopher, the character is a human being's fate. And in some ways, the choices we make determine our character, and our character determines the outcomes of our lives and our decisions.
And that includes hope.
Now, the hope for me is not necessarily in the stories. People often respond to our performances with an overwhelming sense of relief. I know it's hard to believe for people who haven't seen it, and certainly with our traditional notions of Greek tragedy, but after an early performance of Theater of War for soldiers at a U.S. Army base in Germany, a young enlisted soldier raised his hand and took on my question, which I ask all audiences, well, why do you think Sophocles wrote these plays and staged them for his community? And the young man shot back, I think Sophocles wrote these plays to boost morale. And I asked the young man, well, what's morale boosting about watching a great warrior, in the case of Ajax, the play we had just performed, lose his best friend, come unraveled and become depressed, ultimately take his own life? And before I could finish asking that question, the young man shot back to me, because it's the truth. And because we're all sitting here shoulder to shoulder acknowledging it. It's not being whitewashed. We're watching it together. One of the discoveries for me over the last 7 years as I've been touring the world with this work is that there's great hope and great community, profound community, to be found in sitting together for 2 hours in a dark room and facing the darkest aspects of our humanity, not in isolation, but as neighbors, coworkers, friends, and family members all together in one space. That's where the hope is from my perspective.
Brian Dorries is the author of the new book, The Theater of War, What Ancient Greek Tragedies Can Teach Us Today. You just mentioned Ajax. You write about it quite a bit in the book. It is a play about the psychological effects of war. How do you believe that it has helped, and at what point did you realize that it could help people with PTSD?
So Ajax is a story about the greatest, strongest of all Greek warriors who, after losing his best friend, slips into a depression and ultimately, against the pleading of his family and his troops, takes his own life after doing something he thinks is dishonorable. And the play not only depicts his suicide, but it also depicts the impact his suicide has on his family and his friends, manifest on stage in this terrible moment when his wife discovers his body and screams these inhuman cries. And one of the things that's really remarkable about the play, aside from the fact that, you know, one could easily argue that it depicts not just PTSD, but what we're now calling moral injury, which I would say, and I think there are many others who are joining in the chorus and have long been shouting it before I came onto the scene, that moral injury is the signature wound of the returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. Moral injury, as defined by Jonathan Shea, is the betrayal of what's right, usually in a high-stakes situation where someone isn't in complete control. This could be a Marine who's protecting a checkpoint who has to choose between firing on a civilian car that's moving toward the checkpoint and not stopping, or letting that car move toward his fellow Marines and having to live with the decision of pulling the trigger and killing a family. Moral injury could be being ordered to do something that goes against the grain of your moral compass, or feeling complicit in something that goes against the grain of your moral compass. Moral injury can also be betrayal, and the center of Ajax is a story of betrayal. Ajax feels betrayed by his command, by his commanding officers, by his army, and that sense of betrayal and shame causes him to sort of enter into this chain reaction in which he believes ultimately that the world will be better off without him. Sophocles does something really remarkable. He takes us inside the mind of a warrior who is contemplating suicide, not just the outer edges, but in the profound ambivalence and struggle that leads up to that decision. And I know of no other work in Western literature that does it as deeply and as profoundly as Sophocles' play. And so when audience members, especially military audience members, see Ajax and see their own internal struggles that they've never shared with anyone in private, let alone in front of their peers, reflected in an ancient story, they open up and they tell harrowing and life-changing personal stories that in many ways sound like they could have been written by Sophocles.
So two questions about that, and I'll get to, because I want to talk a little bit about the mechanics of
sure.
How exactly you use these and the talkbacks and so forth afterwards.
Yeah.
But we're not just talking about war, we're not just talking about combat-related psychological injury, we're also talking about end-of-life care and domestic violence and political violence and prison reform and disaster and addiction. How have you been able to find specific works that can address those specifically?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the things that's important about the work that my company, Outside the Wire, does is that we're not a documentary theater company. We're not taking stories from people who live today and then reflecting them back to them as if a mirror. We're taking stories from the ancient world or American classics by O'Neill and Williams and Arthur Miller, and we're asking audience members to look at these tragedies, these texts that aren't set in our time or in our communities, and to reflect on what they see of themselves in the stories. And that's a very different posture than reflecting directly back to them something that we observe in them. Through distance, through archetype, through metaphor, we create a safe space where people can open up and share their stories and make connections and talk about what resonates across time and across culture and space with them. So that's one of the main tools of our trade. Now, not every call that comes in, and after Theater of War and its success, we started to get a lot of calls. You know, do you have a play that could help us address this issue in our community. And I wish I could say that after every call, I could just reach back on my shelf of plays and there'd be the perfect one. In some ways, one of the things we suffer from now is a shortage of perfect plays. But for a good amount of time, in the early days of the development of these projects, we did find, incredible fits. We were approached by the NIH to do a play or a project that would confront doctors with their own prejudices of patients who were struggling with addiction. And we chose Long Day's Journey into Night, Act 3, and had actresses like Diane Wiest and Blythe Danner and Deborah Winger, Kathy Chalfant playing Mary Tyrone for audiences of 1,000 doctors at a time. And it really worked. After EF5 tornado struck Joplin, Missouri, we got a call from the governor's cabinet in Missouri saying, "We've heard of your work, and we would love if you would develop a project for our community." So we decided to bring readings of Stephen Mitchell's translation of the Book of Job, a story about a man who loses everything in a day or in an instant when a great wind destroys his home, and a story from the Old Testament and from the Hebrew Bible. And we performed it in a megachurch for as many as 1,200 Christians or fundamentalist Christians on the eve of the anniversary of the tornado, with Paul Giamatti playing Job. And, it worked. People got up and they shared their stories, but they also shared their misgivings about living in a world in which there seemed to be no moral causality, in which a loving God couldn't possibly have wished what happened to that community upon them, and they struggled openly as a community with some of their darkest thoughts. And it's happened time and time again. Sometimes we miss, or sometimes it's too much of a stretch, and then we leave it to the audience to fill the gaps. But for us, curating the right play or the right text and fitting it to the community and its needs is the place we start from. We start from the question of for whom are we telling this, and what do they need, and that determines the play or the text that we select.
So from my understanding, in many ways, you're a call to service agency.
Yeah, we kind of are a service agency. We've got close to 200 actors who've passed through our projects, who are kind of in our dugout, and many of them very famous, as I mentioned earlier. And when they get the call from us, do you want to fly coach and stay in a Holiday Inn and get up at the crack of dawn and perform Greek Tragedy for 1,000 Marines who've been mandatorily made to come watch it? They say yes. They sometimes even give up lucrative work to say yes, because it's very rare in their profession and our profession to do something that feels like it's actually of service for people, that's where we're moving the needle socially with our craft. And after the performances, people line up to tell our actors, their personal stories and talk about how the plays have moved them. Usually to do, very healthy things like talk to their spouses and family members or seek help or, and enter counseling. And I think for our actors and for us, that's, the most rewarding part of it, seeing in the room the immediate impact of what we do and hearing from people even years out about the sort of life changes they made after having one encounter with one of our plays.
Do we do that enough in traditional, I'm going to say traditional theater, but I even broaden it to entertainment in general, of having that experience in the theater or that experience with just reading a story and having that opportunity to talk it out?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, we don't do it enough. I mean, the answer is no. There's room for all types of entertainment in our world today. I don't want to sound moralistic about it, but when I turn on the television these days, I feel like the tone of some of the programming gets more and more cynical and less inclusive. The idea of even a national television moment, given the number of channels we now have, is where people feel connected even in time to people watching something, seems to think of a past. But I think as a culture, we've lost touch with the power of sitting together in a room for a couple of hours and bearing witness to, really challenging subjects. And I think the speed of our life and our mediated lifestyles, there's very few spaces left in our culture where we do that, where we come together as a community and turn off the devices and listen and breathe together and engage. And I do think that that's one of the lessons to be learned from ancient Athens. I mean, the theater was so important to the Athenians that when the plays that we perform were first presented in the 5th century, close to one-third of the population of the city would come sit in the Theater of Dionysus to watch them over a span of 3 days. The courts would empty. There'd be no political activity. The whole city would essentially shut down so that as many as 17,000 people could come together and watch these plays and engage in these issues, these really important ethical issues that are raised by them, not just about war, but about many other subjects. And to me, that seems to be the behavior of a very healthy democracy. It does seem relevant that the sort of that tragedy in that form and really peaked alongside the peak of Athenian democracy, and then kind of went downhill as the Athenians slid away. I think it's a highly democratic form, and it's something that we could certainly use a dose of in our culture today.
You are a translator, and I'm interested in how you know when you get it right.
Well, so doing these plays performing these plays for audiences who've lived the experiences is a great litmus test. In fact, I think anyone who translates for performance in particular, this seems like a must. But I'd also say anybody who's in the arts who really wants to get some clarity on why we do what we do and its effect and its power, putting your work in front of an audience for whom every word could be of life and death significance definitely reorients your relationship to the material and to your approach. So, you know, for me, it's been a collaborative relationship with audiences. I consider audiences as much the translator as I am, because I listen to them and what they say, and over the years have evolved and altered the translations based on what lands or what doesn't, what metaphors and idioms from the ancient world just don't work today, and what things that I've adaptively done just seem too contemporary. It's constantly trying to find something that will work in the present moment. You know, I'm sorry to say that maybe 10 years from now, my translations may not have the effect that they have at this present moment. Because in some ways, in order to keep this material alive, we have to continue to reinvent it over and over again for ourselves and for the present moment. And I think translation, that, especially for performed text, which from my perspective, a translation of a performed text is not a thing to be read as much as it's a blueprint for a felt experience that happens in the company of other people. And so in this regard, it's a very collaborative act, both between actors and audience members, figuring out what's going to work and how we're going to keep this thing alive.
Brian Dorries is a writer, director, translator, and the founder of Theater of War. That is also the title of his new book, The Theater of War, What Ancient Greek Tragedies Can Teach Us Today. The book is published by Knopf. Brian, I can't thank you enough for the great work you're doing, the beautiful book, and spending time with us this morning. I so appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to be with you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. Again, Brian Dorries' new book is The Theater of War. It is published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.